Ukrainian national anthem there for you. It's just here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, a weekly blog talk radio show where we like to discuss important current events for conservatives and others. And today we want to talk about Ukraine and the various threats that Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, has made towards Ukraine, its territorial integrity, its sovereignty, and what sort of risk that poses for any crisis for NATO and the wider world. And we want to discuss these important issues with a former Defense Intelligence Agency and analyst, Rebecca Kofler, who was born in Russia itself and has become a Russian strategy specialist. Well, Rebecca, thank you for joining the show.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Well, just starting out here, what is the interest of Vladimir Putin, for that matter, the wider Russian national interest in Ukraine? What do Russians think of Ukraine?
Sure. Well, what Putin is doing today is not something that he came up with yesterday or even a month before. This has been in the works for probably the last 20 years, or at minimum 10. Russia and Putin have never really accepted the collapse of the Soviet Union. And while everyone in the West was expecting the peace dividend, Russia was simply reconstituting its forces, or like a famous Russian diplomat Gorchakov said, Russia was concentrating. And so Putin wants to reconstitute a supranational state, not unlike the Soviet Union, and Ukraine is a major part of his plan.
Well, now, thinking about this reconstitution of the Russian Empire, you know, after the Soviet Union collapsed, that was really just sort of the new version under communism of the Russian Empire that that came into being after the First World War. What would that mean? Would Vladimir Putin also as well want to take in the Baltic countries, for example, which are members of the European Union as well as NATO? So is that a wider threat to think of?
No, not at this time. I want to be very clear that Putin and his strategist are looking very differently at the Baltics, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. Baltics are part of NATO. So the collective defense, Article 5, applies to them, and Putin would be basically fears. What he fears is an all-out kinetic war with the United States, which if he were to attack the Baltics, that would trigger that. The Article 5 would trigger that. This is why we see him waging what the Russian strategists call new generation warfare, or they have another name for it, asymmetric warfare. So no, Baltics are not part of the plan. Any former Soviet state in Eurasia, especially Belarus, Moldova, some of the stans are part of the plan, but I also want to be give another nuance, is that you mentioned the Russian Empire. So that perhaps is not quite an accurate characterization. I would just call it, and in fact, that's what the Russians call it, the Union. The official name is the Eurasian Economic Union, but economic dominance is only part of it. It is also geopolitical dominance and military integration. So the new union would be a counterweight to the following, a combination of NATO and the European Union. The Russians already have a what they view is as their old version of NATO, which is the CSTO, Collective Security Treaty Organization, which is the entity that Putin used in order to, what I would say, test out his playbook on Kazakhstan, the peacekeeping playbook.
Yes, you mentioned this Eurasian Economic Union, this EU, as it's called, that Putin has been pressing for states of the former Soviet Union and historically part of this Russian Empire to join. As you say, I guess you know, many Russians like Vladimir Putin would believe in what this phrase that came up in the 1990s of the near abroad, right? That these countries surrounding Russia are sort of historically part of Russian influence, and we should sort of be together again.
Yes, absolutely correct, Andrew. And in fact, Putin has been quite clear about his intentions. He didn't make them a secret. There were multiple indications and warnings of Russia's strategic ambitions, and unfortunately, the Washington establishment has missed them all. I have an op-ed running today in the Washington Times that is titled Putin's quote-unquote new war, 20 years in the making, and Washington's strategic incompetence, that I would commend your listeners to take a look at. And so, but with regard to Ukraine specifically, Putin has made many speeches, specifically after he chopped off Crimea from Ukraine. He made a speech how the Russian and the Ukrainian people are one and the same. And then he recently penned an essay, if you will, where he stated the same. So that is how Putin views it, and that's how some of the Russian people actually view it. They believe Ukraine belongs to them, and it's a very complex issue, you know, because of the shared history and a lot of, you know, families are mixed. It's very complicated, and unfortunately, the Washington quote-unquote experts who missed the whole asymmetric warfare that Putin have planned, they simplify it, you know, make it black and white, and they don't explain to the American people how complicated it is.
Well, yeah, I guess you could think of, you know, the relationship between Ukraine and Russia. Maybe you can compare it to, like, you know, the relationship between Germany and Austria. I mean, you think of throughout history, and then finally, of course, under Adolf Hitler, that, you know, he was able to annex Austria and, you know, have this greater Germany. And, you know, there are questions there about just how much of a invasion, a forced annexation that was, or how much Austrians wanted that. Or, you know, you can look at, like, Montenegro and Serbia. I mean, there, you know, many Serbs would say that, you know, Montenegro should be part of Serbia, or even you compare, like, you know, United States and Canada and similarities. Well, looking then at Ukraine, how popular, what do Ukrainians think? I mean, do a lot of people in Ukraine go along with this idea that we should also be along with Russia? Or in contrast, how popular is the desire for Ukrainians to join NATO and the European Union?
I think the Ukrainians are split. No, not all of the Ukrainians by any stretch of the imagination want to be back reintegrated or reincorporated under the wing of Mother Russia. You know, a lot of them want to be part of the West. They want democracy, or their understanding of what democracy really is. But there's a small part, mostly in the East, who, you know, view themselves as potentially, you know, part of the Slavic nation. So it's all, you know, it's very complicated, just like what you described previously. In your case, each case is an individual case. And right now, unfortunately, the United States got in a very difficult position because we were not prepared. We were sleeping at the wheel while Putin was planning this. And so all of a sudden, and very few Americans actually realize that we are effectively on the brink of war because Putin has drawn what he believes is a red line in terms of the incorporation of Ukraine into NATO, and he is prepared to fight, you know, tooth and nail, and this is why we see him mounting a massive military buildup and high-tech weaponry along the border of Ukraine is to telegraph that he needs business. And we, unfortunately, were blindsided and caught off guard, and all of a sudden now we want to, in a matter of weeks, we're going to come up with a deterrence. But deterrence strategy is not something that you just make up on the fly. You really need to do your homework on the adversary, and we didn't.
Well, now, thinking of the Russian population of Ukraine or the Russian-speaking population of Ukraine, as you indicated earlier, how much desire do they have to, as it were, you know, reunite with Mother Russia or be part of the Russian nation? Is there a lot of desire for that? Or is this Russian population in Ukraine in the eastern part, you know, like in the Donbass region of Ukraine, are there more like, say, the Russian populations precisely in the Baltic states, again, that have actually decided that, you know, they would really like to stay out of Russia? I mean, their life is much better off in the Baltic states with their Western orientation, their freedom, their increasing standard of living, their political stability. How's the Russian population in Ukraine break down politically?
Well, they're actually victims of this whole thing. There's no uniformity, you know, there's a difference of opinions, but most importantly, they're just victims of the whole thing because they're Russian, you know, mercenaries, if you will, or another name for them is the little green men who have been waging war for the past, you know, what is it now, 7 years, tremendous casualties. So obviously, none of this is worth it for the whether it's Russians or Ukrainians. For them, it is not the right way of resolving differences. Is to murder innocent people and continue destabilizing that region, which Putin has done.
Yeah, I mean, precisely in 2014, in March of 2014, when you had these little green men, as they're called, they went into Crimea and seized that and were able to quickly grab that. You also had then support beginning from Russia in the Donbass region of Ukraine, bordering Russia, for these, as you say, these paramilitary groups with mercenaries. And since then, I looked at the latest figures, something like 14,000 people have been killed in fighting in Ukraine with these Russian-supported militias. So as you indicate, yeah, it is indeed a bloody conflict for these last 7 years. So could you describe then Ukraine, looking again at this Russian population, you know, Samuel Huntington mm-hmm. way back with his Clash of Civilizations book in the 1990s, Ukraine was one of the countries he described as a torn country, right? That you have, you know, the mm-hmm. western part of Ukraine with mainly Ukrainian population and also with the Uniate Catholic Church, you know, this Catholic church that follows the Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox rite, and then you had, you know, the Russian Orthodox section of Ukraine. Would you consider that accurate?
Yes. There's obviously the Ukrainian, you know, church has been trying, you know, very hard to separate, and Putin has been making it very, very difficult, for them. But yes, there's a segment of the population that are, you know, Russian Orthodox. And as always, we, you know, religious differences are, you know, sort of very, very important. It's a critical issue. A lot of people's identity is wrapped up in that. And but with regard to Putin and the whole, his strategy to portray how the Russian society has become very religious. is actually part of a scheme. Yes, there has been a revival of Christianity and religion both in Russia and in Ukraine, but Putin has also misused religion. He has weaponized it to achieve his goals. The Russian Orthodox Church has been for decades penetrated by Russian intelligence services. And I'm sure you know this, Andrew. And so today, Putin is trying to portray how everything that he's doing is has been a divine inspiration, and he's using the rhetoric to justify his actions that are, you know, turning bloody and half turned bloody. And so people are the victims who are caught in this, you know, terrible ordeal.
Yeah, I guess that brings up another interesting analogy. I mean, here you have, it brings up, you know, there's also the theologians have noted, like George Weigel, the famous American Catholic theologian, have noted that, you know, sort of the history of the Orthodox Church is that it's not necessarily, as it developed, it's not necessarily independent of the state. It was, as we think of, say, like, you know, the Catholic Church or Protestant churches in the West that developed more of an independent status from state authority. But historically, I mean, going back again to the Russian Empire and to the Tsars, you know, church and state were very much united, and the church was very much a support of the regime. And here you have this example of Vladimir Putin, who, of course, is, you know, a former KGB agent. So, you know, I don't know how much, you know, religion there was there in the KGB, but it strikes me as sort of an analogy with, you know, it strikes me as, you know, thinking of Slobodan Milosevic when he came to power in Yugoslavia and then ultimately became the Serbian leader. You know, he was a former communist, you know, just how religious was that guy? But of course, in the Balkans, in the breakup of Yugoslavia, you know, then the Serbian Orthodox Church and religion in general became a key a driver, a key rallying cry. You had then, again, a sectarian split between, say, you know, Catholic Croatia and Orthodox Serbia, and then, you know, the Muslims in between. So it seems like a similar analogy there.
Yeah, so you mentioned Catholic Church being separate from the state. Well, nothing is separate in Russia, okay? Nothing, zero, nothing is separate from the state. Just because the whole, you know, idea of, you know, capitalism and freedom, right, that we have in America is so different from socialism, collectivism, and totalitarian state. Basically, in the Russian, you know, history and even strategic culture, there's a primacy of the state, not of the individual. And this is why the those socialist societies, and not just Russia, but, you know, socialist communist societies, China, you know, also Venezuela, Cuba, some of the ones that you just mentioned, there's no freedom, okay? And so religion is just hijacked, typically, by the state to achieve its means. And so, unfortunately, you can't really, it's a very, very difficult issue because Putin did relax a little bit the, I don't even want to call it freedom because I don't want to use the name freedom in the same sentence with Putin, but he did allow more sort of more religion to trickle down to the people. You know, the Russian people are now allowed, at least they're not prohibited, right, to worship and to believe in God, unlike back in the USSR when the Soviet Union was officially an atheist state and religion was outlawed. And in fact, you know, I was raised in a family where officially, you know, my family was not religious, but later in life, I learned that my grandma on the mother's side secretly baptized me. Subsequently, I adopted Judaism. I became Jewish. But this is just to demonstrate to you that nothing really is you know, and neither is religion in Russia. And so Putin has weaponized it to achieve his objectives.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, secret baptism. Very interesting personal story there. I guess, again, I would think, you know, there's a comparison here, again, of talking about religion and nationalism in Russia. You know, of course, in the Great Patriotic Wars, it's called, you had the Nazi Third Reich and its allies attack the Soviet Union, this communist atheist state. And then precisely mm-hmm. under Stalin, you had this push to sort of revive nationalism, revive religion, you know, to sort of, again, instrumentalize those sentiments, those loyalties, to get Russians to fight for the state. Has there been then under Putin, you talk about this relaxation, has there been a real hunger for religion among the Russian people? Has there been a revival of people wanting to go back to church and so forth?
Oh, yes, absolutely, because there's a pent-up demand in Russia for religion, because remember, they the Soviets have replaced religion with the cult of Lenin and Stalin, right? So as a little girl, I still remember having my very first book or textbook, rather, called Bukvar, or the ABCs, and as soon as you open it on the left side, those portrait of Lenin, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, whom we were calling Grandfather Lenin. So he was officially, quote unquote, God for the Soviets. But the people knew better. The people knew that whatever the communists were trying to portray, how the Soviet Union was the best country in the world and how it was so much better than the United States. People knew better, and they knew that, this is all just a charade. And for a long time, a human being cannot be without any kind of spiritual, you know, energy and support, especially in Russia, where in the Soviet Union, where life was so difficult. You know, there were so many, you know, repressions and shortages. And so people became kind of hollowed out, and they were always yearning for religion. And so now there's a big revival, you know, more churches are opened or, restored. And sort of, and that's different than what it used to be. But unfortunately, a lot of it is also like being pushed for wrong reasons by the Kremlin, you know, and that's just no good. And you mentioned also KGB, you said, I don't know how much religion was there in KGB, and that reminded me that, no, there was zero religion, Andrew, in the KGB, but that reminded me how, remember former President George Bush looked into Putin's eyes and somehow he saw a soul. Well, that was, you know, that was a mistake that somebody did not brief former President Bush, and did not tell him that Russian intelligence services, you know, profile on a regular basis our leaders, and they know our, you know, leaders, what their hot buttons are. And Putin, all he was trying to do, he was just trying to portray himself as a man of God, and so that he could manipulate former president.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important point here. I mean, we have to, you know, there's been some development in the West of, you know, people looking at Putin of, oh boy, you know, he's, you know, reviving religion. He's standing up against for, you know, things like the nuclear family, traditional sexual mores, you know, so, you know, against all this LGBT stuff. But we have to be skeptical here right. of the gospel according to Vladimir Putin, and the issue with Bush, you know, that he said, oh, I looked in his soul. You know, that brings up a whole another issue that you talk about briefing Vladimir Putin and other Russian leaders receiving these briefings. You know, there's that incident where Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, came to a summit with Putin, and they knew that Angela Merkel doesn't like dogs, apparently. So precisely the thing that Vladimir Putin did is he had this big black dog of his just come right into the press briefing that he was having and just, you know, kind of jump around and he petted it and so forth. So, yeah, you know, a real provocation there. I mean, these are people who play psychological warfare here.
Oh, totally. Right on, Andrew. And if I could mention something over here, because you touched upon, you know, Putin being, you know, sort of a conservative in his views in terms of embracing, you know, religion, embracing nuclear family, and being anti-LGBT and all this stuff. All of this is true that you mentioned, right? And that's why it's so complicated, is because, you know, the Russian people in general, they do now want to be to improve their family situations and to have nuclear, they're anti non-traditional marriage, right? But there's also another aspect to it. Russian demographics is very concerning, right? And that is why Putin has adopted several measures to encourage people to have babies and to maintain nuclear families, right? And so for this, so another angle to it is the Russians are trying to cozy up to American conservatives, trying to present that, you know, again, Russian and Americans are all the same. But, and it is true that, you know, American conservatives are pro-family, anti-abortion, anti-like LGBT and all that stuff, and so are the Russians. But it's a very, very different, you know, type of conservatism, because abortions are still like through the roof in Russia. In Russia, you know, again, there's primacy of the state, there's no freedom, and American conservatives value freedom. So from that respect, they are different. But it's hard to blame American conservatives from not kind of like gravitating to that sort of mentality that we hear Putin is about and Viktor Orban and all of those types, because conservatives have been repressed lately in America, right? Conservative voices have been silenced, especially like religious voices have been, you know, silenced, not unlike, you know, the Soviet Union where I grew up. And so I spoke with some of the conservatives who really, you know, believe Putin, and they believe that he's a religious man. And they said, well, Rebecca, with the situation that we're experiencing here in America, we would rather, like, listen to Putin than we listen to, you know, Biden and Nancy Pelosi, who are propagating this, you know, LGBT and all this sort of appended view of the world that man, you know, can be woman and all that nonsense. And so that's where the complexity is.
Yeah, you mentioned, of course, you know, there would be an advantage for Putin to emphasize nuclear family, traditional family, precisely as you say, that this demographic winter among other countries is hitting Russia as well. I mean, you know, the birth rates in Russia, you mentioned abortion, that apparently is, you know, I don't know, I guess Putin's done nothing about that, but, you know, for coming from Soviet times, you know, abortion, you know, became really accepted, and now, you know, the birth rate of the Russians is just plunging, and the population of some 140 million people in Russia is really, you know, just sort of dying off, like Japan or so. Maybe, you know, the only increase in birth rates that you're going to have in Russia are from, say, like the Muslim populations in Russia. So, yeah, that would be something that Vladimir Putin would be very interested. Well, looking at Ukraine, how stable is that country? If Ukraine's talking about joining NATO and EU, are they really developing into a stable democracy?
I don't believe that. I don't believe Ukraine is a, how should I phrase it? It's like complicated. Let me just be blunt, okay? Ukraine is just as corrupt as Russia, you know? And there's it's within the culture, right? And we've seen that corruption unravel during, the whole Hunter Biden, laptop story that the Russian intelligence services followed very, very closely. And as we know now, Hunter Biden had very questionable ties with foreign businessmen, specifically Russian, Ukrainian. And so that country has a long way to go before it becomes a democracy. Just like Russia, just like a lot of other, countries, somehow the Russian establishment believes that it can democratize, everyone from Afghanistan to Iraq to, Ukraine. And that's just not how it works. You can't change, centuries of, of traditions and just culture. It's really like within the corruption, we even have a word and in Russian called blood. There's everything is through connection, through a corruption of one sort or another. And so if Ukraine were to be adopted as part of NATO, which is probably like a long way to go, really, that would present, certain risk to the United States because of Putin's designs on Ukraine and because it is still a pretty corrupt, government out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, one idea I sort of toyed with thinking of Ukraine, could Ukraine undergo maybe something analogous to what was called, the Velvet Divorce of Czechoslovakia, I believe, at the beginning of 1993, Czech Republic and Slovakia just broke off. They had a referendum. Could you make a deal in Ukraine that you could say, like, those areas of Ukraine that really want to go to Russia, like Crimea, considered historically part of Russia and only being given to the Ukraine in the Soviet Union in 1954, or maybe even, like the Donbass region, if they really want to be part of Russia, you could say, okay, they can join Russia, but for the rest of us Ukrainian, we'll work on joining the West.
So I can see how one could be attracted to this idea, but I don't believe it's viable, Andrew. And first is because the United States would not allow this. Okay, we have had a bipartisan long-term policy. It used to be classified, now it's declassified, that, or rather it was leaked back during the George Bush presidency, that our policy is to prevent, official policy, the emergence of a dominant player such as Russia in Eurasia. And so the United States is not going to at first accept the split of Ukraine into two parts because, A, it would append our 72-plus-year policy, but then also it has some strategic negative ramifications, right, for the United States because, China is watching and making conclusions with regard to Taiwan, and it would compromise potentially our access, that type of solution to the Black Sea and those strategic areas that unfortunately President Obama allowed Russian to again establish foothold, in the Mediterranean after 30 years of them not having that foothold. And it's like a snowball, this sort of solution.
A bit more about that. What sort of risk are present in Ukraine if Russia were to increase its influence there or even take over the entire country? I mean, what risk would there be for NATO, for the United States? I mean, you mentioned, maybe encouraging other countries like China to make a move on Taiwan or such. What would be the dangers there?
Well, the interesting thing is, in terms of, like, in short term, there is no risk. Ukraine is not part of NATO, right? It's not part of U.S. vital interests. And what I mean by that is our safety and security, sovereignty, territorial integrity, and long-term survivability are in no way dependent on Ukraine or who, you know, is in charge of Ukraine, whether it's some, like a former comedian Zelensky, or it's Putin's puppet. It doesn't matter, right? So for now, it's not a risk, right? But the risk is long term. It's a strategic, and while it's not part of our vital interest, it's part of our strategic interest. Like I said, right now, the U.S.-Russia showdown over Ukraine is really not about Ukraine, but it is about who's going to call the shots in Eurasia, whether it's the United States or Russia, and who is going to be the leader of the world, and whether the world is going to be, you know, still, you know, if there's hope for freedom, if the United States is going to project power and its own worldview, or whether it's the authoritarian states and totalitarians like Putin and Xi Jinping, whether they are calling the shots and whether they are setting the model of governance and for the rest of the world, right? So we are one model, the United States, you know, with our freedom and democracy, although, you know, democracy right now, there's a tremendous erosion, in my view, you know, in our own country that unfortunately the Washington establishment is not talking about, or whether it is the Chinese and the Russian model, and they're trying to present it as an alternative, actually, for the world. Not just, you know, for themselves. You understand? So it's like, it's basically like what you mentioned, Huntington, right? This is like unfolding right now. The clash of civilizations are unfolding, and we're battling, you know, not just for the territorial, sort of for the influence, you know, of Ukraine and Eurasia, but we're battling what is the world going to look like more, and what we want it to look more like America or like China and Russia.
I see. So you're saying if you let, you know, Putin just sort of have his way in Ukraine, you know, really dominate it, just kind of walk over it, you know, mm-hmm. next he might like, well, I guess Central Asia would be another area, you know, he'll want to really mm-hmm. reassert control over there. I mean, we're seeing all these
right.
disturbances and Russian troops in Kazakhstan, you know, Georgia, of course, yeah. might be another place, you know, he'd want to really assert his control, or I don't know, maybe even Armenia or, you know, Azerbaijan or something. But, you know, certainly I guess he'd be more aggressive in, like, things like, you know, policy in the Middle East, you know, going into Syria and exerting his influence
right.
there. So you're really worried about, you know, it's the falling dominoes, as it were, to use the old Cold War analogy, or the, you know, the sort of the road to Munich and, you know, Munich appeasement in 1938, that, you know, you've got to really sort of show a certain opposition. You can't just let him do whatever he wants.
That you said it even more eloquently than I have. You nailed it. It's the domino effect and sort of the strategic implications. And again, this is why I want to sort of flag this again. We are right now, it's basically the Washington establishment's fault and the ignorance that we exhibited. And all of a sudden now we woke up as though this is some kind of new thing. This could have been prevented, right? You know, Ronald Reagan did put together a strategy, a very long-term strategy that resulted in the collapse of the Soviet Union. And he didn't go to war for that. But, you know, multiple administrations, actually both, you know, Republican and Democrat, right? But especially Democrat, probably with this exception of President Trump. They were just pursuing a foolish, naive, foreign policy towards Russia that was absolutely not grounded in reality.
Well, looking at Ukraine, you know, you're talking about building up deterrence over the long term, you know, talking about an analogy with Ronald Reagan, his whole peace through strength strategy in the 1980s over that decade. What would such a strategy of building up deterrence in Ukraine have looked like, or what should it look like now?
So right now, I can't talk about it right now because it's just simply too late. You can't, there's no magic bullet, okay? So let me talk about the over the long term. So we had the very first, let's say, cyber operation that the Russians conducted targeting the United States, which was multi-year cyber espionage. Was called Moonlight Maze. It was dubbed by U.S. and Canadian investigators, right? That was 20 years ago. Since then, we have done nothing. We also were, while we were fighting in Iraq, Afghanistan, Kosovo, the Russians were watching very closely our war fighting style, and they have concluded that our strategic advantage was also our strategic vulnerability. What is it? It's extreme reliance on technology. We have the best, the world's best weaponry and the world's best trained men, women, and uniform. And so that's why they were developing the strategy that targets our vulnerabilities, cyberspace, counterspace, low-yield nuclear, warhead. So had we paid attention to all of this, we would be developing our own capabilities and strategies that negate Russia's advantage. And actually, former President Trump started doing that, but it was too late. I mean, he didn't come to power until 2016, 2017, right? And even though he came to power, some, you know, corrupt people, including in the government, did everything to disrupt his presidency. But what Trump did is what should have been done a long time ago. He's done three things, a minimum of three things, right, that is constituted a deterrent. First, he authorized offensive cyber operations against foreign adversaries such as Russia, right? Until him, nobody did that. Obama was very afraid of doing that. Next thing, or even the first thing, I would even put it up front, Trump authorized the creation of U.S. Space Force. But that was done a little too late. It was 2018. The Russians established their own space force. That in 2001, after Donald Rumsfeld's commission concluded that U.S. space assets are vulnerable, right? If we started protecting our space assets right at that point, back in 2001, you know, the Russians would not have developed that strategy that they did, which basically called for blinding and deafening our space capability on which we rely for every aspect of warfighting, targeting, you know, missile warning, reconnaissance, everything, right? So these are two things that President Trump did. And then the third thing that he did, he authorized the development of low-yield nuclear warhead, and that strike directly at the heart of Putin's nuclear doctrine, which calls for use of tactical nuclear weapons to de-escalate and end even a conventional conflict on Russia's terms. Okay, that's what the deterrent strategy looks like, but it takes years. You can't right now all of a sudden, you know, do something in Ukraine and assume that Putin, all you can do, all that Biden has done right now, it increases the probability of conflict and increases the probability of our men and women, you know, if he sends them, you know, burning in Russia's nuclear furnace. You know, I'm exaggerating, but not by much, because every single war game that I participated in, Blue lost, okay? Because blue, because red made, and by blue I mean the our force, good force, because the red did their homework on the U.S., which they consider still the main adversary. We did not do our homework in depth on red.
I see. That's interesting. But you say that Putin, on the other hand, he still fears the American military and its NATO allies, right? But you're saying, you know, our edge is, or the Soviets are, or the Russians rather, are looking at, you know, these technological weaknesses, this reliance on space and technology and so forth. But in the Baltics, you say they still really fear, like, you know, the conventional capabilities of the American military.
So yes, but here's the nuance. He fears the conventional, you know, conflict and the United States intervening and actually fighting against Russia. But it's exactly for that reason that he developed, or on his orders rather, a top secret plan was developed. And again, I would direct people to read it in the Washington Times. This plan was developed how he envisioned to actually defeat the United States, even in the conventional conflict. And that's where the nuclear employment comes in, right? So with regard to Baltics, you mentioned, that applies to him not out of the blue take over Baltics, right? Because that is certain to trigger U.S. intervention because they're part of NATO, right? So it's two different things. First is like the intent, what triggers the conflict. And then second is how Putin intends to, like, potentially win should the war break down between the U.S. and Russia. How he intends to win on terms favorable to Russia and what he will bring to bear. And this is all described, by the way, in my book. I don't know if we talked about my book. My book is Putin's Playbook, Russia's Secret Plan to Defeat America, that came out in July. And right now everything is unfolding, actually, you know, according to Putin's playbook, just like what I wrote up. And this is precisely why the U.S. government tried to sabotage the publication of my book, is because, you know, there was embarrassing information to them, and they blacked, you know, how unprepared they were, A, and also how they misused the intelligence resources to unseat former President Trump instead of really working on foreign targets and doing their homework on Russia, China, you know, Afghanistan. Look at the disastrous, you know, withdrawal. You know, it's because we're paying attention to bright and shiny objects and misuse our, you know, exquisite resources that are designated for foreign adversaries. We misuse them for spying on Americans like Carter Page and like trying to unseat, you know, democratically elected president instead of really targeting foreign adversaries.
Well, looking at more specifically, I mean, you talk about needing to maintain American strength. But what about Ukraine in particular? Would it be a proper strategy over the years, long term, to build up the defenses of Ukraine? I mean, we have recent arms shipments coming in from the United States and other countries, Czech Republic, you know, NATO countries, you know, like particularly anti-tank missiles and so forth, to build up Ukrainian defenses. Is that then an important strategy that we have to strengthen the defenses and domestic institutions of Ukraine so it can really present a strong deterrent against a Russia trying to take over?
Okay, so two separate answers. With regard to democratic institutions, I don't believe we should be helping because the cardinal rule, really, of that sort of help, you can't want democracy more than the country that you're trying to help, right? They need to decide how to do this, and they need to do this. On the weaponry and the augmentation of defensive capability, if that were done over the long course, right, and if it were done in a way that would augment their indigenous capability. That's one thing, right? Doing it at the 11th hour, because remember, the President Obama was giving them blankets. Doing this at the 11th hour is more likely to be perceived as a precursor to escalating conflict. That's how the Russians could be misinterpreting it. Okay, so yes, I guess right now we have no choice if we want to keep Ukraine, but it's highly, highly, highly risky. This should have been done a long time ago, gradually, and instead of throwing out weaponry at them, because you have to train the people, right? We already threw tons of weaponry in Afghanistan, and, you know, people who come from the field, remember, I'm a former defense intelligence officer, and they would, you know, they observe how even if you give superior weaponry, if you don't have the culture of, like, how to use it, how to maintain it, it all ends up, you know, ruined within a year and inoperable. So you have to train your allies over the long period of time, which would allow them to establish a different culture in terms of and a different, you know, skill set of how to use this type of weaponry.
Yeah, so maybe for the present time in Ukraine, should we try to – you think it would be advisable for American policymakers maybe to, as it were, sort of de-escalate, like maybe we can say the Russians, like, we have no present plan to bring Ukraine into NATO. You know, that would be something – we're not thinking about that right now, and sort of really push that issue off into the distant future. And then slowly you could build up Ukrainian defenses and institutions so that Ukraine over time, over the years, could become stronger, more solidified, and could then be able to stand more on its feet against any Russian threats.
Yeah, that's so it's a tough one, I think, and this is exactly why the Biden administration is sort of, vacillating and kind of like going from one extreme to the other. And they, if anything, they are trying to hype up the conflict. Even President Zelensky, the Ukrainian President Zelensky, is not happy with our president by really, you know, unleashing all this hysteria. And because I think the Ukrainians, you know, they have a country to keep and they have to keep their population not agitated over this and be ready to fight if they need to. And by hyping up the threat, it sort of gives a green light to Putin to do, and in fact, Biden just said as much, that a small incursion is just fine. So, again, it's just very difficult if you signal to Putin that it's okay, you know, for now, let's de-escalate. I think the plan is already to take over, well, take over may not be the right word, to take action, whether it's, you know, that false flag operation that the State Department says that the Russians are planning to install their own puppet, or whether it's a kinetic strike or an outright attack. That is pretty much, you know, imminent, meaning like next few weeks. So de-escalation is probably the best step right now, but it needs to be done, again, from the position of strength. And there are non-kinetic means to achieve that, but I'm just not comfortable talking about it on national radio. Again, I'm an intel officer, and I have obligation to, you know.
All right. Well, excellent. Yeah, well, excellent. Well, Rebecca Kofler, you've given us a lot of food for thought here, a lot of things to think about in this very tense situation. And for our listeners out there, you've been listening to Rebecca Kofler, a defense intelligence agent, former defense intelligence agency analyst and from Russia, born in Russia, discussing the current Ukraine crisis. And we hope you'll join us next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Harrod, where we like to discuss important events for conservatives and others. and Rebecca Kofler. Thank you for joining the show, and where can we learn more about you, your books, and your writings?
Yes, so I have a website, RebeccaKofler.com. That is R-E-B-E-K-A-H-K-O-F as in Frank, F as in Frank, L-E-R. I'm on Twitter, RebeccaEd0132. I publish my op-eds in the on Fox News, in New York Post, Wall Street Journal, The Hill. So you can just Google Rebecca Kofler Russia or Rebecca Kofler Putin, and you can find all my writing. And by the way, I'm launching my own podcast, Andrew. So I could invite you to my podcast called Johnson,
yeah.
But
right.
Not Silent.
Excellent. All right, then. Well, for our listeners out there, join us next week, next Friday, for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday. Thank you very much.